Leistad wanted to get up and hit him. Never mind. On with the show. Go back to work, back home, and watch TV. He put his foot on the accelerator and drove off. Durim Redzepi remembered how dark it had been in Vanja Kvalheim's flat the day she died. He remembered hearing her come up the stairs, fumbling outside the door, the key slowly slipping into the lock, as though she was completely exhausted by a full day's work at the Major Stuhr clinic and had no more energy left. The shock on her face when she'd come into the living room and seen the light from the TV reflecting on the ceiling, and then seen him and Jeton Pokali sitting on the sofa.
"Do you seriously record the bold and the beautiful?" he'd asked.
It was a good opening line. Not threatening. But Mrs. Kvalheim hadn't been able to say a word. She just stood there, staring.
"How many episodes are there of this crap? 18,000?
Who are you?"
"You don't even need to watch this shit to know what's going to happen."
What do you want?"
Redzepi had looked at the TV screen for a few seconds before freezing the picture and throwing down the remote control. The sudden loud noise had frightened Mrs. Kvalheim.
"But I think I know why. Look at that guy there."
He'd taken a few steps towards her as he pointed at the screen, stopped right in front of her.
"He's the spitting image of your son."
And then she'd started to cry. Vanya Kvalheim had probably just realized why he hadn't bothered to cover his face. Why he was wearing gloves. Why they'd closed all the curtains. Why Jeton Pokali just sat there, looking at her.
"Where is he, Vanya?"
"Who?"
He'd laughed at this. So helpless.
"Please," she said. "I don't know where he is."
And they had seen the tears in her eyes, her pleading face, watched when her knees buckled.
"What do you reckon, Jeton? Does she or doesn't she know where the carpenter is?"
Jeton Pokali had stood and taken a step towards her, then shrugged. Redzepi had produced a small box from his jacket pocket, opened it, taken out something that looked like a pin, which he kept in his hand. From the other pocket, he'd taken out a small glass bottle that contained a clear liquid. It looked like water. With great care, he'd slowly removed the lid.
"I've only used this on a cat," he said. "Do you remember, Jeton?"
Jeton Pokali had nodded.
"It's really nothing much."
"What do you mean?"
"But we do know it works on humans, too."
Her lips had started to quiver when he dipped the pin carefully into the clear liquid and then held the point up to the light so that a drop fell on the carpet.
"I believe you," he said finally. "I really do believe you don't know where your son is."
At the same time, he'd nodded to Jeton Pokali, who took another step closer and grabbed her by the arms.
"But we're going to have to kill you anyway."
It had been a good death, a simple one. It was how they should have killed Henning Jewell as well, but hopefully there would be more opportunities. He should really have stayed hidden away in the forest, now that he was wanted all over Norway. But they'd planned the operation for so long, and as he was in charge, he had to be there. It wasn't, however, such a good idea to be seen on the streets, but it was helpful to have Florim Amataj's friend working with them now. He'd been quick to say yes when they needed someone to break into Nora Clemetson's flat the day before. Redzepi kept his eyes on the monitor. The funeral was over. Flurim Amatage turned on one of the wireless cameras they'd installed in a tree nearby, and he saw a man in a digger filling the grave. Their plan had failed. The carpenter hadn't shown up to say goodbye to his mother. Daddy Longlegs would be furious. Again. Flurim Amatage folded his hands behind his head. His friend was sitting beside him, his thigh muscles twitching, ready to jump out if necessary. Jeton Pokely was hunched forwards, resting his elbows on his knees. The van reeked of sweat.
"How long do we have to sit here?"
Pokely asked, and looked at his watch.
"A bit longer," Red Zeppi said.
"How long is a bit longer? I mean, he's obviously not coming."
Red Zeppi sent him a dark look.
"We'll sit here until I say we're done sitting here. You got a problem with that?"
"Yeah, I don't like wasting time."
"Who says that?"
Amatage straightened up, tapped his finger on the screen in front of him. Red Zeppi leaned closer and smiled. Bleistad stopped at a petrol station just outside Oslo to fill the tank. The wind was sharp on his face, but he couldn't care less. It felt wrong to leave without having seen her, without a proper farewell. He hadn't dared earlier, afraid that someone would be waiting for him. But he'd bought flowers, roses, his mother's favorite, and he'd got himself a new suit and shoes. When he'd filled the tank, he sat in the car with his hands on the steering wheel.
"You coward," he said to himself. "Your entire life is a joke." The thought of her lying there in the ground, alone, without him even saying goodbye, was like a scratch record in the background of his mind.
He started the engine and turned around. Accelerated. 20 minutes later, he was back at the cemetery. The sky was still grey and heavy, but it wasn't raining. There were no cars left in the car park. No people around. Bleistad turned off the engine and took a deep breath. Waited for a minute or so before he opened the door and got out. His new shoes were uncomfortable, like he had a plaster cast on his feet, and they clacked loudly as he walked on the asphalt, and then crunched when it changed to gravel. There was only an old man left in the cemetery, and it was not hard to see where she lay. Bleistad walked over the grass between the gravestones, not looking at the names, the flowers, candles and lanterns round about. He stopped in front of the grave, a mound of earth and a cross bearing the name Vanya Kvalheim. Bleistad was glad that the grave diggers had already filled the grave. He couldn't have coped with seeing the coffin, the flowers that were to be buried with her. Bleistad had expected it to hurt, but the pain was sharper and deeper than he'd imagined. His dry throat swelled, and he found it hard to swallow. He sobbed, then looked around surreptitiously. There was no one else there. He approached the mound of earth and laid the roses by the white cross, lowered his head and folded his hands. Somewhere in the distance, a car door slammed. A chainsaw started up. He felt like he should say something, but no words came. Bleistad didn't know how long he stood there, but it was a long time. The earth was dark and fine, and she was lying in the dark, gone, forever. Eventually, he turned and went back to the car. He had felt a need for some time, but it was stronger now, perhaps stronger than ever before. He couldn't, did not want to spend the night alone. Durim Red Zeppi kept his eyes on the monitors, with one hand round a small, thin microphone.
"He's nearly there," he said. "Is there traffic around you?" No, was Jeton Pokali's reply.
Good. Get started. You've got plenty of time, but make it quick all the same, and get the registration number.
Got it.
Red Zeppi watched the man's heavy steps. Flurim Armitage moved closer, switched to another camera that showed the carpenter from an angle that caught him face on. Suddenly, the sun broke through the cloud and illuminated him. The grass around him lit up. The carpenter had one hand in his pocket. He was looking around. There was a crackle on the communication system.
The package has been delivered,
Pokali said.
Good.
I put a tracker on the car and his overcoat. He hadn't taken his mobile with him, so I put one on that too.
Even better. Now, move it.
Red Zeppi looked back at the monitor. The man stopped in front of his mother's grave, a pile of earth. It was tempting to kill him right there, lay him out on top, but it would be too risky, and would require an aim that none of them was capable of achieving. It was too far, and the risk that there would be witnesses was high. Red Zeppi jumped when the back door of the van opened. Jeton Pokali got in and sat down, took out his earpieces.
Here,
he said, and handed over a piece of paper with two letters and five numbers written on it.
The registration number.
Red Zeppi handed the piece of paper to Armitage.
An address would be good, he said, in case we lose him.
We won't lose him.
Armitage took the number. Red Zeppi continued to watch the carpenter's movements while he waited and thought about Henning Jule. They had shot him too soon. They hadn't waited for the prime moment. This time, they would get it right. They would take this man out at close range, when he least expected it. Chapter 38. Given the occasion, it didn't seem appropriate to drive fast, but the car rattled and shook all the same. Roger Bleichstadt's only toolbox knocked against something in the back. The nail gun, perhaps, and the noise provided a kind of companionship. He neither knew nor cared how long the journey back to Brandbu had taken. It was as though his hands on the wheel and feet on the pedals had a will of their own. Before he knew it, her house appeared in the distance, and it was only then that he really registered where he was. As he drove into the residential area, a boy on a bike followed him with his eyes. There was house after house, rows and rows of them, gardens and hedge and garages with gravel driveways. Even though it was autumn, the colours around him had a summery feel, green and fresh. In some gardens the branches on the apple trees were heavy with overripe fruit. It was a quiet afternoon. Should he go on? He released the brake, let the car move on until he was outside her house. He stopped. The brakes complained. Even then, Bleichstadt still wondered if he should turn around, but he turned off the engine and got out. No, you really shouldn't, he said to himself. She'll think you're mad. He looked up at the house. Helene was standing in the window, looking straight at him. Roger Bleichstadt thought, you can't turn back now. It's too late. To begin with, she was clearly surprised to see him there. Then slowly, a smile appeared on her lips. Even at a distance, he could see that they were soft and red. She opened the window, stuck her head out.
Well, hello, she said. Where are you going?
He had no answer. He was there to see her. Her.
Did you take a wrong turn or something?
No,
She was nearly hanging out the window, and Bleichstadt thought, Just one push from behind by an ill-intended hand, and she would topple out into the bushes below. The thought, the image, made him smile.
"Hang on, I'll come down."
She straightened up and closed the window. Bleistadt stayed where he was and looked around, wiped his hands on his trousers, put them in his pockets, and stepped back. Then the door opened. Hélène came out, without the Stetson this time, in wellies, tracksuit bottoms, a tunic, and a jacket on top. She had her hair in a ponytail. He took a step towards her, stopped, ran his hand through his hair. This was a bloody stupid idea, he told himself, but her smile had him captivated.
"Wow, you're looking smart," she said as she came towards him. "But why did I say smart? I should perhaps have said handsome, because you're looking very handsome."
She grinned. "Has someone died or something?" Bleistadt was about to say something, but stopped. His lips parted. She must have seen his expression, his mouth that locked because she rushed towards him, her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, my God," she said. "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to..."
She stopped herself.
"I'm always putting my foot in it," she said, looking at him with sympathy. "I'm sorry."
"Not to worry." She bit a nail as she gazed at him in silence for a few moments. Bleistadt didn't know what to do with his hands. Was it someone close? Family? Or a friend?
"My mum,"
Bleistadt said. She opened her mouth again.
"Oh, Roger."
"I'm fine."
"Oh, sorry, that was so stupid of me."
"It's fine. Really."
Hélène just stood looking at him. Bleistadt felt he should say something, but he couldn't. His mind was stuck on his mother and the fact that he was somewhere he shouldn't be. He wasn't used to talking to people anymore.
"Were you close?"
she asked after a while. He nodded.
"Well..."
He couldn't sort out his words, his memories, all that he wanted to say but couldn't.
"Yes. Yes, we were."
"Would you like to come in and have a cup of coffee?"
He looked around again, saw a curtain twitch in the neighbor's house.
"Thank you. That would be nice," he replied eventually, and smiled again.
Hélène smiled back, then turned around and started to walk towards the house.
"I've got some food left from lunch as well, if you'd like it."
"No, thanks, I'm not hungry."
He followed her in. Everything felt awkward. For 2 years he'd run from shadow to shadow, only allowing himself minimal contact, only meeting and greeting the odd client. He knew the people at the sawmill, of course, but really only to say hello. They sometimes had a quick chat over the counter, but never anything personal. He took off his shoes, even though she said it didn't matter. It felt good to get them off. But his socks were a bit clammy. He hoped they wouldn't leave a mark on the newly cleaned floor. Prayed his feet didn't smell. But all he could detect was a hint of floor soap. It reminded him of his mother. She was always cleaning, and the house was scoured from top to bottom every Friday so she could relax over the weekend. He went into the kitchen behind Hélène.
"Sit yourself down," she said.
It felt like an age since he'd sat in exactly the same place, after he'd finished replacing the timber panels on her south-facing wall.
"I should perhaps offer you something stronger than coffee, but..."
Bleistadt looked up at her. Was there a subtext to her suggestion? An invitation?
"Thanks, but..." "No," he said. "I don't drink much these days."
"I thought maybe a dram for your mum? Do you have far to go? Of course, I know you live in Brandbu."
"Yes," he said, "I do."
There was enough coffee for two in the pot. She reached up on her toes to get a cup down from one of the top cupboards. Her tunic slid up, and he caught a glimpse of her skin, her waist. In the light that shone through the kitchen window, it was the same color as the beaches in Natal. So, tell me about it, he said. She turned to look at him. What? You said you were always putting your foot in it. Give me an example. She smiled teasingly and took her time. No, I don't want to. Please, I could do with a laugh. She poured the coffee, shook her head, still smiling, and leaned back against the counter. It looked like she was weighing up the pros and cons. I was at one of those water parks once, she said, and pushed herself away from the counter, lifted her hand and brushed her fringe to one side. You see real women's bodies there, and when you start looking, you realize there are so many variations. I'm sure you men do it, too. Bleistadt couldn't remember the last time he'd been in a shower room. Probably back in the early 90s, if he thought about it. He thought about all the muscles and tattoos he'd seen there, hardly the norm for the male population, but nodded all the same. Anyway, I was standing in the shower beside a little girl. She was maybe 3 or 4, and she didn't want to get wet, no matter what, and she was howling. And her mother, she was, well, pretty big, so I said to the little girl, "Why don't you just hide under Mummy's tummy?" It was only after I'd said it that I realized she wasn't actually pregnant. Bleistadt threw back his head and roared with laughter, and Helene giggled sheepishly. It was the first time he'd heard her laugh, restrained, as though she didn't dare let go. "You can imagine the look I got from the mother," she said with a big smile. Bleistadt had to wipe his eyes. "That's a good one," he said. Their laughter subsided, but she continued to smile, and he sat happy to be on the receiving end, helpless, like some idiot who'd never seen a woman smile at him before. But it melted his heart, the block of ice that had lain frozen in his chest for so long. "Not easy to talk your way out of that." "No, I made a quick exit to the pool, I can tell you." Bleistadt chuckled. Then the moment passed and he drank some more coffee. Helene leaned back against the counter, but looked at him over the rim of her cup. He could see her blue eyes, the long lashes, the neat brows. "What about you?" she asked. "Have you ever made a fool of yourself?" "Me?" He smiled and started to laugh again. "I never put a foot wrong." It was her turn to laugh. "Never." And again, he noticed the suggestive undertone. It wasn't really a question. There was something challenging about her voice, as if she wanted him to do something bad. "No, I mean, I've thanked people for gifts they haven't given me, that sort of thing." "Ah," she said, "that doesn't count." "No," he agreed, "maybe not." There was a short silence. Helene continued to watch him over the rim of her cup. "Can you bear to talk about her?" He lifted his head abruptly, felt his stomach burning at the very thought. Then he lowered his eyes, didn't quite know where to begin. But he took a deep breath and started at the beginning. How his parents met, on the boat to Denmark, in the queue to pay for food and a glass of wine. How they started talking and neither of them wanted to go back to the people they were with. That they kept sending each other looks across the tables. And when they then bumped into each other by the meat counter in a shop at Frederikshavn, they both felt it was fate. They agreed to meet when they got back to Oslo. "But my dad was the sort who could never sit still," Bleistadt said. "He was always on his way somewhere else. Even after he and my mother got together and had me and..." He changed his mind. "Mum was left on her own with me when I was 4. He couldn't stand it any more, and I've never seen him since."
"Not even at the funeral?"
"No, I..."
He just shook his head.
"I think he went to sea or something like that. He's probably dead as well."
Helene nodded quietly. "So you've got no one left?" Her voice was tender and sad. His chest tightened. He shook his head. "But you must have some friends who can look after you."
But that was the problem. Friends.
No, not so many of those, either, really.
Helen put her cup down carefully and came towards him, with slow, deliberate steps. And when she leaned in towards him and kissed him on the mouth, he let it happen. He let her take control, allowed himself to be led, and when they made love a little later, it was fast and furious. She wrapped herself round him and pulled him down towards her. It was strange to feel a woman's hands on his body again, after so long. Afterwards, he lay looking at her as she rested beside him.
"So," he said, "tell me your story now."
She turned towards him, her neck and cheeks still flushed, her hair all over the place. Beautiful.
"Just when we were having such a nice time?"
She tried to laugh it off, but he wasn't willing to let her get away with it.
"You haven't told me anything about you,"
she tried.
"I've told you about my mum."
"Yes, but you're not your mum."
"No, but I've already told you things I don't normally talk about. That way I'm still on top, and you've some way to go."
She smiled. Bleistad could see that she was going to say something crude, but she refrained. Instead, she looked up at the ceiling and asked,
"You don't happen to have a cigarette, do you?"
"Yeah, I..."
Bleistad started to get out of bed.
"I haven't smoked for 4 years," she said.
He stopped and turned to her.
"Then you're not going to start again now."
"I want a cigarette, Roger. Now."
It was her turn to sit up.
"Please, Roger, just do it, okay?"
He could see she was on the verge of tears, so he went out into the hall and got the cigarettes from his jacket pocket and the lighter from his trousers. He lit 2 cigarettes and handed one to her. Bleistad was still naked, but it didn't feel awkward or embarrassing. She took the cigarette, put it between her lips and closed her eyes. She coughed a little before she took the first puff, and then another.
"Ah,"
she said, blowing the smoke out slowly. "I'd forgotten how good it was." She tapped herself on the forehead.
"Why use the past tense when it's something I'm experiencing now?"
"It is good,"
Bleistad said, and took a drag himself.
"But I think one's enough,"
she said, and sucked in more nicotine.
"I'm starting to get a head rush already."
She let out a little laugh. Bleistad crept down under the duvet again, turned over onto his side, and looked at her, and the long ash tip on the cigarette that would soon fall. There was an empty Coke can on the bedside table. She reached out for it and used it as an ashtray. "I used to smoke in bed," she said, putting the can down between them. But it wasn't the can that Bleistad was looking at, nor the cigarette, nor her eyes, but her arm. He hadn't thought about the fact that she wanted to keep the tunic on, but at some point the button on the sleeve had become undone, revealing her lower arm. All the scars. A puckered spider's web. Helen noticed him looking at it, pulled down the sleeve and put her arm under the duvet.
"We don't need to talk about it," he said. "We don't need to talk about anything you don't want to."
She lay down again and stared at the ceiling, motionless, as though she'd found what she was looking for up there. After a few seconds, she took another drag on the cigarette.
"What else are you called, besides Helen?"
"Don't you remember?"
she said with some indignation. Bleistad wasn't sure whether she was joking or not.
"You just gave me your first name when you called about the job," he said.
"Oh, right,"
she said, and continued to stare blindly at the ceiling.
"Ness. My surname is Ness."
"Helen Ness," Bleistad said.
"Well, do you know what, Helen Ness?"
He waited until she turned to look at him. "My name isn't really Roger." Chapter 39. Henning opened his eyes. He blinked, but couldn't get the room into focus. There was something familiar about it, though. Something about the colors. The size. He lifted his head, still heavy after such a long, deep sleep. And then it dawned on him that he was back in hospital. If it wasn't actually the same room as last time, it certainly looked remarkably similar. The table was the same caramel color, the same strip lighting in the same rectangular box, which reminded him of an exceptionally long bread tin with two tubes in it. The walls were the same color, eggshell. He saw a print of a pot plant on a round coffee table. What the hell had happened? How had he ended up here? The most obvious answer would be that Anne-Marie Sarah had driven him here, or called the police. But she wouldn't have done that. The police would want to know why Henning had gone to her house on the day that he'd been shot, and she was hardly likely to want to do anything that might identify her as his secret source over the years. But the fact that he was awake and alive did seem to indicate that all his assumptions were wrong. But how, then, had Red Zepi found him? Had someone else at the police station told him? All these thoughts made Henning dizzy again, and he wondered what the doctors had given him. So he closed his eyes and felt a heaviness pressing down on him. The next time Henning opened his eyes, Bjarne was sitting on a chair beside his bed.
"Good morning," Bjarne said. "Or rather, good afternoon. It's 5:30. In the evening."
Bjarne gave a fleeting smile. Henning took a moment to focus his eyes. He tried to pull himself up into a sitting position, but he'd forgotten that one arm was still in a sling. There was a stabbing pain in his shoulder, and he managed to bite back a scream. His efforts made him sweat.
"How are you?"
Bjarne asked. "How long have I been here?" Bjarne looked at his watch.
"About 17 or 18 hours."
Henning stared at him. That was a long time.
"I think they gave you some sleeping pills," Bjarne said. "They had to do something to stop you."
He smiled again.
"What were you thinking? Going out the same day you'd been shot? That's asking for trouble."
Henning blinked furiously. Was it the same day? He realized it was. Time had lost its importance. Only answers mattered to him now.
"I had to check something out," he said.
"What?" "Doesn't matter now. I got it sorted. Nothing important." Bjarne scowled at him for a few seconds.
"Do you know how you got here?"
Henning stalled before shaking his head.
"You don't know?"
Bjarne looked at him, astonished.
"No," Henning said. "Do you?"
The policeman waited a moment before continuing.
"You were found outside A&E, sitting, or rather half-lying, in a wheelchair."
Anne-Marie Sarah, Henning thought, as he cast about for something to say. Luckily, Bjarne didn't ask any more questions. Henning wondered what he'd missed in the last 18 hours, if Durim Red Zepi and his mate had been arrested in the meantime. He asked. Bjarne shook his head. Neither of them said anything for a few moments.
"We found Ivar Gundersen's car keys, Henning, in your trouser pocket."
Henning lowered his eyes. He was still a bit groggy. Any movement took time.
"That wasn't very smart. I could arrest you for obstructing an investigation. There'd be no problem getting support for that at the station, let me tell you."
Henning didn't say anything.
"Why did you take them?"
He thought about what he should say.
"I needed transport," was his simple reply. And your own car wasn't working.
Henning shook his head, uncertain whether the lie was visible in his face or not. The door opened, and Ella Sandland, one of Bjarni's colleagues, came in. Her smile was terse when she said hello. Sandland was thin and sinewy in a masculine way, and her movements were also quite macho. She hooked her thumbs into her uniform belt. Henning knew that Sandland was one of Bjarne's allies down at the headquarters, and that she was aware of his suspicions regarding Preben Merk. So he told them about the meeting he'd had with the lawyer, the parking ticket he'd found in Ivar's car, and the business card. "It's undeniably odd that he should lie about Ivar having been there," Henning continued, spurred on by the fact that his head seemed to be working again. "And another thing, of course Tor Pulley knew who gave him the contract to murder Ellen Hellberg in the 90s. That might be why they had to kill him. Merk needed to make sure that Tore wouldn't snitch on him." Bjarne and Sandland looked at each other. Bjarne nodded to her. "I got Örjan Mjerns in for questioning a few days ago," she said. "As expected, he denied that Merk had paid him to kill Pulley. But there was a reaction, albeit small, when I mentioned Merk's name and held up a photograph. Daddy Longlegs and Merk have to be the same person," Henning thought. "But was it Merk who was in the car beside Tori the evening his flat went up in flames? Who had ensured his name was deleted from Indicia?" The probability was high, given that Merk would certainly not want to be associated with Tori after Tori was killed. And yet Henning was unsure if Merk could be anything other than a middleman, or if he had enough financial muscle to pay for a contract killing on his own. Whatever the case, the question remained. How could Durim Redzepi know that Henning was going to be outside the police headquarters at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? "William Hellberg described Merk as solid," Henning said, "but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. If Merk helped Hellberg's mother with the murder in the early 90s, he may have been leading a double life for years."
"But we can't just call Merk in for questioning," Bjarne said. "We have to have something on him first. Proof, something concrete, like Gundersen perhaps had. Merk has been in the game a long time. He knows how to counter our questions, if we're just fumbling in the dark."
Henning moved slightly and was racked again by pain.
"Sounds like you've got enough to do over the next few days," Henning said and winced. "What about me?" "The doctor thought it would be best for you to stay here tonight," Bjarne said. "And I think that sounds sensible. We've got a man in here keeping watch, and another outside."
Henning lay down again. He was, truth be told, utterly exhausted, but he knew that his mind would not be able to switch off. Not now, not when they were so close. "What are you going to do?" he asked. Sandland and Bjarne looked at each other.
"We're going to dig a bit deeper into Preben Merk's life," Bjarne said. "See what we can find. But I wouldn't set your hopes too high, Henning. We've done some pretty thorough investigating already. He doesn't have a single blemish on his CV. People talk about him in glowing terms."
"But there must be something," Henning said. "Ivar found something, and we have to find it as well."
Bjarne took a step closer to the bed and put a hand on his shoulder.
"We'll do all that we can."
Chapter 40 Later, after Roger Bleistadt had driven home, he regretted it. Not the few hours he'd spent in Helene's bed. That had been pure pleasure. But the fact that he'd exposed himself. He'd been quick to cover his tracks, hadn't said anything about Tora or Charlie, only that someone was after him, and he didn't know if he was out of danger yet, which was why he'd taken on another identity and was lying low. It was perhaps wrong, he thought, to have left so soon after, but he'd felt restless and uneasy, like a fire was burning under his feet, and he had to get away, go home, so he could think about what he was going to do with the past, with the future, with the present. Perhaps it was time to forget the past, to stop running away from it. "But if you'd like to meet again," he'd said to Helene before he left, "you'll have to carry on calling me Roger, so I don't get confused." She'd looked at him for a long time. Maybe she just needed a shoulder to lean on as well, someone to give her a cigarette. She was glad, she said, that he'd been so open with her, and now Bleistad wasn't sure if that was a good or a bad thing. For the first time in ages, he felt like food. So he went by the shop on the way home and bought bread, cheese, fruit, and vegetables. When he got home, he ate two slices of bread before sitting down in front of the TV and channel-hopping a bit, before settling on an athletics program. And as he watched the people running, it dawned on him that he hadn't done any exercise for a few days. So he changed into his running gear, went down into the basement, and started the 45-minute treadmill program. Found the album he'd downloaded onto his phone that he liked listening to when he was training, the soundtrack to Rocky IV. At his heaviest, Bleistad had weighed 112 kilos. Then one day he'd got out of the bath and been horrified by what the full-length mirror had so mercilessly shown him. He got himself a treadmill, started to record each session, kept a note of how many calories he ate and burned. His project was to lose weight. The target was 80 kilos, the same as he'd weighed when he started high school. He was only 5 kilos short of that now. The cellar was Spartan and dirty, with uneven walls and plaster dust constantly falling everywhere. The floor was uneven too. It was amazing that he'd managed to find an area that was flat enough for the treadmill, but he liked it down there. It reminded him of Rocky when he was training for the Ivan Drago fight, with Training Montage by Vince DiCola and Survivor's Eye of the Tiger playing in the background. The rough, masculine cellar was inspiration in itself, and always made him want to watch the film again. He'd got to Robert Tepper's No Easy Way Out when a shadow passed the cellar window. He looked up, alarmed, and saw another shadow stop by the front door. Bleistad pressed the emergency stop button and jumped down from the treadmill. Through the window, he could see the men outside huddled together and talking, but he couldn't hear what they were saying. They were both dressed in black. One had a hoodie on, the other a denim jacket. The man closest to the window put his hand inside his jacket and took out something that he then fiddled with. It looked like he might be turning it round and round. Then he lowered his arm. Bleistad gasped. From where he was standing in the basement, it was easy to see the gun and silencer, and he knew immediately that they had found him, and what would happen. What the hell was he going to do? "You have to get out and run for it," he told himself. "Somehow get the rucksack you've got ready for emergencies." The problem was that it was in one of the cupboards in the bedroom. Upstairs. There was no way out of the house other than through the door where the two men were now standing. They didn't ring the bell. Instead, Bleistad heard the glass pane being smashed. He looked around the room. Weights. Too heavy to swing as fast and hard as he needed. Mats, medicine ball. Nothing he could use as a weapon. He didn't even have the keys to the box room. He tried to control his breathing, but it wasn't easy. His heart was hammering in his chest, as though it would jump out. He couldn't remember if he'd turned the TV off or not, but it wouldn't be more than a few minutes, maybe even seconds, before they came down into the cellar. And what would he do then? He couldn't just stand there and wait for them to kill him. The cellar window, he thought. He could climb up and slip out. No. It was too small and too narrow. It wouldn't work. Bleistadt dialed the emergency services and put his phone down on the treadmill. He didn't want to talk. It would give away his whereabouts to the men upstairs. They would see where he was calling from at the control center, and then, when he didn't answer, they would send a patrol round to check. Wouldn't they? But it would still take some time before they got there. Bleistadt didn't know where the nearest police station was, and how much time he had was questionable. He put down the headset and looked around the room again. He had some rope he could use if necessary, but the others had a pistol. He needed something he could surprise them with, something that would quickly put them out of action. Footsteps on the floor above. They were in the bedroom. Soon they'd find the door that led down to the basement. Bleistadt left the room and went into another. He moved as lightly and silently as he could, past an ice pick. Tested it. Far too heavy. Garden hose, too unwieldy, tires, buckets, piles of wood, paint brushes, paint tins. How strong were they? If he could only rid them of their guns, how good would they be at fighting? Bleistadt hadn't fought with anyone since high school. To a certain extent, his stature had meant that people generally avoided confrontation. But he was fitter now than ever, so he might have an advantage. He couldn't go upstairs to turn off the light, because then they would hear him. There was no switch at the bottom of the stairs, but he had turned the light off in the room with the treadmill, so only the stairs were lit up. A foot on the top step. He tried to draw the air deep into his lungs, hold it for a while, and then exhale slowly, but couldn't do it. His heart was thumping too hard. More footsteps. Just one set. For now, he heard a sound. Knew what it meant. Bleistadt lifted the spade, ready to strike. Wiped the sweat from his face on his shoulder, making sure not to hit the wall with the spade. Footsteps on the concrete. Something loose crunched on the floor, more feet at the top of the stairs. Bleistadt knew he only had a couple of seconds. Then there would be two men instead of one, and when the gun appeared in front of him, like a long finger, he whacked the hand holding the gun with the spade with all his might. The gun fell to the floor. The man was surprised by the sudden attack and screamed with pain. Bleistadt didn't think about hitting him again. He threw the spade down and picked up the gun, pointing it blindly at the stairs, from where a short, bald man came running towards him at full speed. Bleistadt didn't think. He just pulled the trigger, three shots, in quick succession, and judging by the sudden splash of color on the wall, he'd hit his mark. The man fell forwards and landed at Bleistadt's feet. All of a sudden, he felt something heavy bang his head, hard enough to make him see stars for a few seconds. He'd completely forgotten the first man in the chaos, but he saw him straight ahead through the fog and pointed the gun in his general direction, waving it around. He was about to pull the trigger when he felt a hand clamp over his, which forced the muzzle of the gun upward. So when the shot was fired, plaster dust immediately sprinkled down from the ceiling. Some fell into his eyes. He blinked frantically to clear it at the same time as he tried to gauge the strength of the man who had hit him. As the tears cleaned his eyes, his sight returned, and he took another deep breath. He had the advantage of a few kilos over the other man, and he managed to push him so far into the room with the treadmill that they hit the wall. The man groaned, but was not put off his stride, not by a long shot. He raised his knee and hit Bleistadt in the stomach, knocking the wind out of him. He dropped the gun, and before he managed to straighten up, the man had bent down and picked it up. Bleistadt threw himself at the man and managed to grab hold of the gun just as he fired a shot. He felt a wave of air rush past his face and bent his hand away from his body as more projectiles ripped into the walls around them. Their faces were only centimeters apart, and Bleistadt headbutted him as hard as he could, twisted him round, and pushed him over to the other wall. He butted his head again, hard enough to make the man crumple in his arms, and he used the opportunity to thump his hand against the wall several times until his visitor dropped the gun to the floor. Then he pummeled his face and upper body, punching as fast and hard as he could, aiming for the man's nose, because he knew that the bone in the nose was easy to break. He felt and heard it crunch under his knuckles. Finally, the man sank to the floor. Bleistadt stood with his hands on his knees, gasping for breath. But he knew he didn't have much time. He had to get out and away as fast as he could. He stood up again, wiped off the sweat and blood and plaster dust as best he could. His hands were shaking. There wasn't time to think, and he saw his mobile phone flashing on the treadmill. He rushed over, saw that someone was calling, and ignored it. He didn't want to talk to anyone in emergency services now. It was too late for that. Even though it was self-defense, he had killed someone, and he had a record that would not play in his favor. Bleistadt ran out of the room and stopped abruptly by the man who was lying there. He had a gun in his hand, but there was no doubt that he was dead. Bleistadt hardly dared look at him, but he did, all the same. Saw that one of the bullets had hit him in the chest, another a little further down. The third bullet had hit the wall. A moment later, he heard the man in the room behind him gasp. Bleistadt stepped over the body and ran up the stairs as fast as he could. He dashed into the bedroom, picked up the rucksack, knowing that it didn't matter what he left behind in the house. It would be impossible to hide his tracks anyway. So he just grabbed the most important things. Car keys, credit cards, put on a pair of shoes by the door in the hall, pulled on a jacket and ran out of the house, where he was met by a welcome cold wind that stripped off a new layer of sweat that had formed on his skin. He was just about to get in the car when the side mirror splintered. The man he had knocked unconscious was standing in the doorway with a gun in his hand. He was obviously still groggy, because he held onto the doorframe when he fired another shot. The bullet flew over the top of Bleistadt's head. Then the man charged down the steps onto the gravel. There was nowhere to hide, other than the car, and he wouldn't be protected there for long. All he had in the car were his tools. Lots of tools. The heavy steps lurched closer over the gravel. His mobile phone started to ring. For a moment, Bleistadt was completely paralyzed. Then all at once he did the first thing that popped into his head. He opened the boot and rummaged around. The nail gun. He couldn't remember if it was loaded or not, but he picked it up. In itself, the nail gun weighed nearly 3 kilos, and judging by the extra weight, he guessed there were nails in it. Luckily, he didn't need any plugs, cables, or compressors. He simply switched it on and held it out towards the house. He didn't even aim, just fired away. He knew that a nail gun could spit out up to 60 nails a minute, so he just carried on. Bleistadt saw that he'd hit his target, and that the man staggering towards him had been caught off guard. Soon, he was lying on the ground screaming, holding his face with both hands, his gun beside him. Bleistadt dropped the nail gun, hurried over to him, kicked the gun out of reach. One of the nails had hit the man in the eye. His phone continued to ring, but Bleistadt still didn't answer. Instead, he turned and ran back towards the car with only one thought in his head, to get away. Chapter 41. Durim Redzepi waited, and waited. It was supposed to be an easy job. Jeton Pokoli and Flurim Amitage's friend, in and out, 2 against 1, 2 experts against an unsuspecting idiot. What the hell were they doing? How hard could it be? Red Zepi ran his fingers through his hair, looked at Armitage, who was leaning back, totally calm, as if he didn't have a care in the world. For him, it was simply a matter of doing the job he'd been asked to do, getting the money, moving on. They were on overtime now, and some, and he was bored. Red Zepi took his wallet out of his jacket pocket and opened it, took out the photograph of his girls. He'd done this so often, the picture was in danger of wearing thin. He'd called home the day before and spoken to his brother Jetmir, who didn't really want to talk to him. Or that's what it felt like. He couldn't wait to put down the phone. Said that Misha was screaming in the bedroom, but Red Zepi couldn't hear a child crying. Jetmir was just fed up, Red Zepi thought. Fed up of him calling and nagging, only to get the same answer. No, Durim, with a sigh in his voice. We haven't found your girls. And he knew what his brother was thinking. But Jetmir didn't know what it was like to live with no answers. The pain had dulled over time, but the fire was still burning somewhere inside.
Do you ever think about the people back home?
Red Zepi asked. Armitage sent him a lazy look, took his time.
There's not much to think about.
What do you mean?
It's another life. They're there. And I'm here.
Red Zepi nodded pensively.
So you've never thought about going back?
Armitage shook his head.
Why would I?
Well, I just thought, like me, you've got no roots here, no family.
Armitage leaned back again and closed his eyes.
I'm happy here, he said. I don't need a family.
There was silence, but Red Zepi continued to think about Kosovo until there was a beep on the screen in front of Armitage. They both sat up. There was movement on the GPS trackers. All of them. Red Zepi looked at Armitage.
How can he be on the move now?
He rang Jeton Pokoli. No answer. Tried Fleurim's friend. With the same result.
Shit,
he said to himself and started the car, put it into first gear.
Where's he heading?
He'll be on the main street any minute now, Armitage said. Then we'll see.
They stared at the monitor, waited. A minute passed. Shit, Armitage said.
He's coming this way.
Red Zepi thought hard. He looked at the gun lying beside him. He couldn't shoot a man through a car window, not when the car was moving. There was a food shop on the other side of the road. People might see them, see the car, tip off the police.
Here he comes,
Armitage said, and pointed out the window. Red Zepi followed the red car with his eyes, saw the carpenter behind the wheel. Alone. What the hell had happened? Red Zepi stared at him as he passed.
Are you not going to follow him?
Armitage asked, when the van Bleistad was driving turned out onto the main road. Red Zepi shook his head.
We've got him on GPS.
Red Zepi was more concerned about Jeton Pokoli and Fleurim Armitage's friend, as neither of them had answered the phone. It was obvious that they hadn't done the job. Red Zepi drove towards the residential area where he'd dropped them off only 20 minutes earlier. He stopped outside the red house and saw Jeton Pokoli lying on his back in the front yard, not moving.
Keep an eye on where he's going,
Red Zepi said, pointing to the monitor. He got out and hurried over to his friend, who had dark stripes of blood running down both sides of his face.
Get me away from here,
Pokoli begged.
Get me to a hospital. This is fucking agony.
Redzepi looked away, thought about what might happen. A stint in hospital, questioning, the possibility of too much talk, everything. Too risky. No gain. He picked up the gun that was lying beside Jeton Pokoli and remembered what Daddy Longlegs always said about critical situations. It was all about damage control. Durim Redzepi put the gun to his friend's head and pulled the trigger. Roger Bleistadt couldn't slow down, even though he knew he was driving much faster than he should. The adrenaline was pumping through his veins. He looked at his knuckles, still bloody and raw from the fight. He replayed what had happened over and over, hitting the guy with the spade, the gunshots, the man falling down the stairs, the fight that followed, and the bullets he dodged. It was like a film he couldn't stop. The worst thing was the open eyes, devoid of life. He now knew why they always closed dead people's eyes. And the blood. All the blood. Bleistadt had seen a dead person before, but only from a distance, from the third floor in Eckersberg's gate. He had still never dreamt that it would feel like this, so intense, so juddering, so sickening. And now? What was he going to do now? Where was he going to go? The emergency control center had rung him again, and when he was finally calm enough to answer, he told them that his three-year-old son had got hold of his phone and pushed the buttons. Bleistadt had done his best to assure the man on the other end that everything was fine. He overtook a small car that was driving religiously at the speed limit, checked in the rear-view mirror, couldn't see anyone following him. There was no reason to, either. The two men had come to his house, easy enough then, you would think, to kill him. There weren't likely to be more. Or were there? He hadn't seen a car outside, but they definitely hadn't got there on foot. His car was so big and heavy that it wouldn't be hard to catch up with it. He decided to dump it as soon as possible, but first he had to find somewhere safe. But should he go to the police or not? The right thing to do would be to hand himself in. But then again, he'd shot someone with a nail gun. He'd killed a man. He could, of course, plead self-defense, but did that guarantee that he'd walk free? Would he survive another spell in prison? No, he thought. He would rather chance it on the run. And now he was driving to Oslo, the largest city in Norway, the easiest place to disappear. He would find somewhere out of the way to park, book into a cheap hotel, and then try to work out what to do next. Maybe head down to the continent, take the train to Gothenburg and go east from there. There were plenty of options. There was nothing for him in Norway. Mariana was dead. His mother was dead. Nothing left to fight for. Or yes, thinking about it, perhaps there was. Bleistadt struck the steering wheel. Wasn't it about time that he stayed in one place?